Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, Adam Coe and Alex Quigley join us to discuss if charter authorizers can accurately predict the success of future charter schools. Then on the Research Minute, Amber reports on a new study examining the effects of including parental preferences in algorithms assigning students to schools. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I want the listeners to notice that David Griffith used an American football analogy in that answer. This is amazing.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guests for this week, Adam Coe and Alex Quigley. Adam and Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, Adam is an assistant professor of education at the Rosser School of Education at the University of Southern California, and Alex is the executive director of the Durham Charter School. Excited to have both of you here. I got to give a little shout out to Adam, an EAPS alumni, Emerging Education Policy Scholars, this great program we run with AEI for, as it says, emerging scholars in the area of education, and they come to DC, we give them a whole song and dance, and among other things, talk about, hey, you know, here's how you can try to get your research into the policy mainstream. And here we are, Adam, on the Education Gadfly Show, talking about a Fordham study of his coming out next week. So we're excited about that. Let's talk all about it in Ed Reform Update. Okay, guys, so the new study coming out, do authorizer evaluations predict the success of new charter schools? This looks at data from North Carolina, where in the years that you all studied this question, there was a board that reviewed charter applications, and then there were votes, and we have data on how many people thought the school was worth supporting, and we have their reviews on various plans within their applications, and we're able to try to tease out, you were trying to tease out, how good these folks were at predicting charter school success, right? And this is part of this larger debate in our world where, you know, some of us, including at Fordham, where we are actually a charter school authorizer in Ohio, you know, believe that this authorizing role is super important, an important form of quality control, both on the front end, in terms of picking proposals that we think are likely to be successful, and on the back end when it's time to close low-performing schools. Others, maybe some more from the libertarian point of view, think that it's getting in the way of parental choice because, you know, these authorizers end up saying no to some proposals that maybe could end up becoming good schools or at least schools that work for some kids. And so that is a bit of the context. Adam, why don't you tell me what more do we need to know about this study? What were you able to look at? And then tell us, what'd you find?
Yeah, thanks again for having Alex and I on the show today. We pulled together data from charter school applications and from North Carolina's State Board of Education, their meeting minutes, which gave us information around how members of the Charter School Advisory Board voted on approving or not approving or the recommendation thereof to the State Board of Education. And it also had, as you mentioned earlier, the ratings from external evaluators that have experience in the charter world on specific domains, their education plan, their financial plan, governance plan, so on and so forth. And then we were able to connect this with school and student level data, and which included a number of our outcomes. So I think one kind of cool thing about this work is that we wanted to expand our definition of kind of traditional success outcomes beyond just achievement measures. And we also looked at the school level, you know, some of our goals, right, for new charter schools are to open on time. Hopefully they're meeting enrollment targets. And so we included these other outcomes in our analysis in addition to growth scores in reading and math state standardized assessments.
Okay. All right. Great. All right. Well, then we'll let you, Alex, tell us what were the findings.
Well, I had had talked to Adam about this because I was the vice chair of the authorizing board for 2 years and then the chair of the board for 6 years, and always wanted to know the answer to the question that that he posed, you know, how did our votes and how did the thresholds of votes as well as the external evaluator ratings, you know, impact those outcomes, and was really curious about that and asking at the board all the time, could we figure this out? But clearly the study, the getting answers to the questions was way more complex than just than anything I could have imagined. And I think that, you know, the findings are at least showed that I think schools can at least are more likely to open their doors and open on time when we have a higher positive response, both in vote totals. So the threshold of votes and evaluator ratings. Also that in general, we found that the more reviewers voted to approve the school, they performed slightly better in math, but not in reading. And then one of the other really important findings was that there was alignment in the education plan and financial plan to predicting math and performance. You know, Adam would be the one to talk about kind of reading and math and how that plays out. But that was affirming to me because as a charter operator myself, but an authorizer on that board, I felt it was always really important to dig deeply into those ed plans. That is the part that you cannot just pay someone to write your vision for your school and get into the weeds about how you will implement a curriculum and drive student results. Also, if you can't fund the ed plan effectively, none of it's going to work. So I was excited to see that correlation. I'm sure Adam has further thoughts.
All right. So Adam, this is the key question. I just want to make sure we get it right for our audience. You know, these are some positive findings, but it's not like they're overwhelming, right? This is not these are not hugely significant findings. You know, they're somewhat modest on the student achievement front, for example, but also what on opening on time, on hitting enrollment targets. And I always think of it, but tell me if this is a good analogy. I think about it, some of these studies where people, which has been in the news recently, these studies saying, well, you know, does the SAT predict college GPA? And people say, well, there's some prediction, but it's pretty weak. But the challenge is you can't look at all on the GPA of students who don't go to college, right? I mean, so you lop off. And so same thing here. We don't know anything about the schools that were not approved and were not allowed to open and how good or bad they might have been. You might hypothesize that they, you know, these people knew what they were doing. They were going to turn out to be pretty bad schools, but we do not know. So all we can do is look at the differences between the schools that were approved. You know, some ended up being stronger than others. And there was some connection between, you know, what these reviewers were looking at in these applications and their votes and their proposals and what we see in the real world, even if it's rather modest. Did I say that okay? What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, we can only collect future success data, right, from schools that actually opened. And so these were essentially the best of the best applications, right? And so we're working with sort of a smaller group of applications that will have a little less variation in what might necessarily play out, what's in their application. But I would say, you know, still a modest set of findings within this small group is pretty telling. And I think very, for me, a sort of a nice pat on the back, right, for the authorizers that are able to differentiate some of the better and not as great outcomes for approved charter schools.
Great. David, not only are you the co-host, you were working on this project over the last couple of years, right? And helping these folks. And so as you think about it, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, a lot of it's already been covered. I mean, I think it's a fun project. It is challenging, right? Because the bad schools, by and large, didn't get created. So we're essentially assessing the board's ability to predict the difference between good and great, right? And that's tough, right? Anybody who's ever drafted a quarterback knows for the NFL that it's tough, right? You know if somebody is good at football, but it's hard to say if they're going to be a backup quarterback or a starting quarterback in the NFL. And so I think it's kind of like that. I'm quite confident, based on my conversations with Alex and just looking at the track record here, that a lot of bad schools were prevented from opening, right? But yeah, it's, you know, nobody has a crystal ball, right? And it is kind of hard to just talk to somebody, read an application that they've written, and then know how their school is going to perform 3 or 4 years down the road. Being a principal is complicated. Kids are different than adults. An interview is different from a meeting with parents. And you can't simulate a lot of this stuff very effectively. So, you know, I think we really unearthed a couple of important things here that have been mentioned related to the education plan and the financial plan. Those are intuitive findings to me. But I think we need to keep working on it because obviously nobody wants to close schools, right? Like, that's incredibly painful, And so any genuine, authentic guidance that researchers can provide on this front, I think is worth its weight in gold. And so I think this was a step down that road.
That's great. That's great. I want the listeners to notice that David Griffith used an American football analogy in that answer. This is amazing. You didn't say soccer. You talked about football quarterbacks. I love it. What is going on? So, and I do like that you looked at things like enrollment and opening on time. You know, as an authorizer, I will say, you know, we approved a school to open in Ohio that I have to say I was always a little skeptical that it was going to find a market. It seemed like the kind of school that maybe would be good in a bougie suburb, and instead this was going to be in an urban area. And lo and behold, they really struggled to get enrollment. I ended up closing because of low enrollment after just a few years. Now, there was the pandemic. There were a lot of other issues. Maybe it would have made it were it not that. But that's really important because, you know, on the one hand, you could say in the venture capital world, you say, well, you know, we're going to make some bad bets and we're going to have, you know, and that's okay. And you got to take some risk. And there's some truth to that. But you know, we're talking about expending public money. We're talking about kids having to, you know, go to new schools and then having that school closed. I mean, this is not without costs if you get this wrong. So you do want to have a system where there's some risk taking and you can't get rid of that entirely. But, you know, if you can anticipate some things, we have learned some things over the years, over 30 years of charter schooling, that it's hard. And it's hard to both to run a great school. It's hard to attract families. It's hard to make the budget work, especially in states where charters don't get the same amount of money and are underfunded. And so we shouldn't pretend otherwise that, you know, every plan has the same possibility of success. So what else would you say, either Adam or Alex, to other folks in this authorizing position? If as you look at this study, also other studies that have been done in this world of charter authorizing, what message would you give to folks?
One thing is I appreciated that the paper landed on that authorizers need to pay attention to multiple data points. And so I think about that both in the kind of hard data, it says data sources and perspective. So I think that's really important. So what is the hard data that's evident that you can pull through? Have you really thought through how the curriculum is going to be implemented? One of the questions I often ask is, walk me through what a day is going to look like in terms of how the kids, what type of instruction, what are the minutes down to the instruction, how have you planned that, what's the curriculum you're going to implement that you're committed to. But then there's a whole host of intangible factors that the board is trying to assess in these meetings with these proposed boards. And that was a fascinating exercise, but I think the more, in some ways, I would to build our capacity as authorizers, we should, you know, and this is obviously something NACSA does, is like have development on how do you assess these, particularly boards that are not associated with an EMO or a CMO and don't have it, where you can't pull the data of existing schools or schools in other states to assess their quality. And, you know, there's a variety of pieces that we would try to look at when we evaluated that board. But there was also an element of, okay, do we feel A, they're committed, B, they, you know, it's Shark Tank and they came with their plan and they were ready to talk about it. And it was clear, they understand their application and they understand the financial plan. And there is an element of intangibles that you're trying to evaluate. And I think we as a board got better and better at that over the years. So I think, you know, that's an important aspect of this for me. And I'm back on the charter school, what is now the Charter School Review Board, and always trying to think about, you know, how do we do this work better, and have often cited the previous forum study that talks about having a leader, having a leader identified is particularly correlated with charter success. And I have seen that, I have seen that play out in multiple instances in my experience in authorizing.
All right. Well, we will have to leave it there. Again, thank you so much, Adam Coe and Alex Quigley. Check out the study, Do Authorizer Evaluations Predict the Success of New Charter Schools? Thank you guys so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Great. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, congrats to you and your team on another great Fordham Institute study on charter school authorizing.
I hope folks find it useful. It's not a topic that gets a lot of love, so.
Yeah, I know. It's a little wonky. It's a little niche, right? Not just charter schools, but charter schools authorizing. And the findings are nuanced. But look, for those of us that do authorizing, this stuff matters. You know, we're always trying to figure out how to improve our processes, as well as have these conversations. Are, you know, when we're making decisions on who should be approved or not, you know, it'd be easy to just be super, super strict and barely approve anybody. But then we wouldn't have new charter schools and we wouldn't have innovation. And on the other hand, you go too far in the other extreme and let 1,000 flowers bloom and a bunch of them are poison ivy. That's not good either.
Well, especially if you're not going to shut them down after, you know, 3 to 5 years or whatnot. So it is a tricky balance. But yeah, the more studies we do, the more that we'll understand about how to get it right.
That is correct. Well, that is a good segue to our research minute. What do you have for us this week?
All right. We got a new study out from New York City's. Researchers there are looking at their centralized enrollment and school matching system. I think most folks know that families in the Big Apple are, in theory, allowed to apply to any school in the city, regardless of their address. And so they're looking at, okay, how does this actually work in practice, which is important to get under the hood of these programs. Specifically, they want to know, does it give disadvantaged families more access to high-performing schools? They have access to restricted use data on kindergarten enrollment applications. So they're just looking at the little guys in kindergarten. New York City, they have enrollment data from 2015-16 through 2018-19, right before COVID. They're only looking at kids in the traditional district schools. They're taking out the kids who applied to gifted programs or charter schools or special education schools and the like. But after they do that, they've got a pretty big sample, 233,000 kindergartners attending one of 743 schools across the 4 years of the study. Let me give you a little background on how the enrollment process works, which is kind of key to this whole study. So kids are assigned a priority rating of 1 through 8, 1 being the highest. If you're a 1, that gives you the highest priority when you live in both the school zone and you have a sibling enrolled. Then that's followed by those who live there but don't have that enrolled sibling. Then the next priority goes to kids who live outside the school zone, but in the larger district and have a sibling there. Then it goes down to you're in the larger district, you're not in the zone, but you don't have a sibling. Then there's preferences for kids who attended a public pre-K program at the school to which they're applying. And on down to the least priority, which is the kids who are outside the district. Then on top of all that, families that apply before the application deadline, apparently they have 6 weeks to decide on their choices. They get priority, whereas families who don't meet that deadline are generally offered only schools that have remaining seats. So their analysis, really, when you get down to the nitty gritty, they're looking at the likelihood that students received their first choice school as compared to students who selected the same first choice school. And I don't know, this shouldn't be a shocker, but giving all those priorities I just went through, their key headline is that oversubscribed and high quality schools enroll smaller proportions of students from disadvantaged and minority backgrounds. Specifically, Black students were 14 percentage points less likely to match their first choice school than white students. So next, they really try to dig in and say, okay, how much of this priority system is at fault and is it a factor? And they find that the differences in the rankings explain the demographic differences. In fact, the Black-white difference in the probability of matching to your first choice school was reduced over 14 percentage points to less than 1 percentage point. And the pattern was similar for the Hispanic kids. And then they just keep saying, you know, if you prioritize residential location in a fairly segregated city, you know, that's going to be the primary issue here. And then they dig into more of the potential drivers, and they find that families of color are less likely to meet the application deadline, perhaps because of higher rates of mobility. So they're not getting access to the most sought after schools. And then they also say that, you know what, a lot of disadvantaged families also still put down their neighborhood school just because transportation can be more of an issue, which is also problematic because 87% of on-time families overall who choose their neighborhood school as their first choice actually get it, compared to just 6% who do not rank their zoned school first. And I'm a little broken record here, but when the algorithm prioritizes match to your zone, kids of color, who, by the way, were about 7 to 8 percentage points more likely to choose outside of their attendance zone, by extension, are going to be less likely to get that first choice school. So then we get this nice discussion, just wrapping it up, about, okay, what do we do? And the authors say, hey, we know getting rid of zoned school preferences, sibling preferences, and pre-K priorities are going to be kind of an uphill battle politically. But then they throw out this other idea. They say, you know, they could use a diversity code, which I can't remember, some other city does this, for each 4 to 8 block neighborhood, which reflects neighborhood racial composition, not at the individual student level, and reflects income level and adult education level for that neighborhood, and then reserve a portion of the seats for the underserved kids in those less diverse neighborhoods. And then, hey, we could have more high-performing schools, so kids aren't fighting to get in them, but, you know, that's a little easier said than done, as we know. That's what I have.
Well, very interesting, and I'm glad they are digging in under the hood and some amazing data. And these are always great to see the revealed preferences, right, of parents instead of just survey data. None of it surprises me. You know, as you may recall, as our listeners may recall, 10 years ago now, I published a book called The Diverse Schools Dilemma, dug into a lot of this stuff. And look, I don't know, call me a cynic. Most people don't call me a cynic. They call me a squish instead, right? But I just don't see a world in which we're not going to give preference to parents for the schools that they live closest to, right? Now, that is not to say that there's not things you can do on the margins, like be really smart when you draw the boundaries. And so, you know, if you can draw school boundaries in such a way that you try to make the schools more diverse, or as was the case in Tacoma Park where we used to live, you make a larger boundary and then you put, one school within that boundary is K-2 and the other school is 3-5. And that's a way to try to make it more diverse. I mean, there are things that you can do, but this after the fact thing with the algorithm, look, you know, people are not going to be okay if they have to travel, are forced to travel and walk their kid past 1, 2, 3, or 4 elementary schools on the way to the school. That's just not realistic in my opinion. So to me, it's okay. I mean, I get it that there are these disparities, but I kept wondering, boy, I would wonder though, if in the absence of this effort, in other words, just do what most school districts do, which is none of this, right? They just assume you're going to go to your neighborhood school and have very little choice. Otherwise, what would it look like? And is this making it at least a little better on the margins? Because maybe there are at least some schools out there that are better than what some of the kids would have access to in their neighborhoods, and they're getting into them.
Right. That's right. No, I think you're right. I think, you know, some effort is better than no effort. What do you think about this diversity code thing? It seems a little orchestrated.
This is the same point. I mean, okay, sure, you could. I mean, they're trying to figure out a way to make it race neutral and pass constitutional muster, but it's still the same problem. It would spit out a result that says, well, for this complicated reason, you're not going to be zoned to your neighborhood school. You're going to have to go to a school outside your neighborhood. And yeah, guess what? Most affluent and middle-class parents are going to hate that. And I just don't see the politics.
Yeah, and what a shame that in New York City, where you've got a subway system, you know, that transportation is still a big issue. I mean, obviously, this is the elementary school level. So who knows what it could have looked like if we were talking about, you know, older kids. But obviously, that's sort of a, you know, that's a big difference here in terms of the, you know, the kids who aren't going to be able to, you know, get on the subway by themselves.
That's right. That's right. All right. Well, hey, interesting stuff. Thanks for bringing it to us.
Indeed.
All right. Well, that is all the time we've got. So until next week.
I'm Amber Northern.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.